Olmert, Sharon, Livni, Netanyahu, they're putting the entire Israeli program into an apartheid narrative. And they're putting the entire state of Palestine into a ghetto narrative. So Canadian foreign policy and the creation of a ghetto state in Palestine is actually not some kind of extreme fringe of analysis. It's the core analysis, it's the anchor analysis that we'll deal with in the Israel-Palestine conflict for the next generation. Because when Netanyahu says that he wants a provisional Palestinian state, as we saw, the reason they want a provisional Palestinian state is because it's already encircled by the wall, which is finished virtually. And they want a provisional Palestinian state because they don't want to have Palestinians vote in election, because that would be the end of their state. And if they don't vote, then it's an apartheid state. So in order to prepare the landscape to deny the apartheid narrative, they're creating a ghetto state. And Canada is at the linchpin of this program. In fact, they're the lead of this program. They're proud of it, and it fits within their entire foreign policy transformation, which takes place and has examples and expressions in Haiti, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and now in Libya. So that was essentially what I wanted to say. I wanted to frame this in terms of a structural program so that we as a movement don't deal with each conflict with a clean slate as if it's something completely different, but we deal with this as the planners of these projects are, as Sharon and Olmert and Netanyahu, as Harper, McKay, and Hillier are doing. That is, as the core of the foreign policy apparatus as it's expressed in Palestine. Thank you. Now, if people want to talk about any of the other amazing things going on in the world, I'm happy to chat about it. And if people want to weigh in on that, one of the reasons why I've worked in Palestine for the last decade is because I think that one of the biggest failures of our media is this concept of sort of parachute journalism, where we send our journalist to Libya today to tell us the most important things we want to know about Libya. She's never been there before. She just said today on the CBC, this is my third day in Libya, and you know, a third day in a country, you know, you wouldn't even, as a tourist, you wouldn't even write an email home with things that you thought about your third day in a country. But for us, that's where we're getting our news from. So I will say, as a caveat, I'm not an expert on, well, now should we list all the uprisings? Bahrain, Yemen, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Egypt, Syria.
I just thank you so much. Before you start answering questions, I just wanted to mention to people that one of the things that's going on here in Nova Scotia that's still a little bit sort of under the radar, that was in the Chronicle Herald, was Chief of Staff of the Nova Scotia government putting out feelers on building stronger links between the Nova Scotia government and Israel at precisely a time across the country when there's a real mobilization to break down the relationships that exist between academia and economics in relation to Israel. So there is a little letter here that we prepared for anybody willing to sign it. We will take it with the stamp and put a stamp on it. But if anybody's willing to send a letter to Daryl Dexter to explain to him that you're not interested in seeing a greater relationship between the province of Nova Scotia and the state of Israel, we have these here, and I really invite people to sign them and the outside of the envelope. So I just wanted to say that. Thank you so much. I'll just walk around and hand these around.
Yeah, slightly puzzled. I think you were talking about what the Israeli government was doing or wasn't doing with regard to the people in Gaza's access to food. That would seem to me, in the lead up to the Israeli invasion of Gaza, or the attack on Gaza in 2008-09, and subsequent to that, the Israelis had the Palestinians in Gaza by the pinies in terms of their access to food. But were you talking about that when you were saying that the I mean, the Israeli policy obviously is not to disturb the Palestinians in Gaza. That would look too much genocidal, you know, in the face of that. But you were saying, were you talking about Gaza in that instance? Or talking about
yeah.
Okay, so, but I mean, yeah, they aren't going to be disturbing the people of Gaza. But I mean, what would you call it? Would you just call it, you know, an aspect of tightening the screws or keeping the screws just tight at a certain level in so many ways around Gaza? Because they're obviously making life extremely hard.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think for the sort of people interested in sort of public health aspects from here, I think that it's important to note that the impact, the health impact of these policies, they take time to be known, right? I mean, the anemia or whatever in kids, or malnutrition, how that impacts development. You know, these are generational statistics. So collecting, I mean. Even I remember working with the World Health Organization director in Gaza, and that during the time of the sonic booms, when the Israelis would fly planes and break the sound barrier, and it would sound like an explosion, the lights would collapse, and people were having stillborn births and whatnot. But because of the way that the science works, you can't just say that was created. You know, you can't say the heart attack was because of the sonic boom. You need to have this sort of corollary data around it before you can make this sort of proclamation. But every single human rights organization that works in Gaza has spoken out numerous times about the impact of the starvation type policies on Gaza in terms of its effect on children, its effect on, its effect on the economy, and all of those things those are there to be known, right? There's no import or export from Gaza. There's no independent economy. There's no ability to ever, rebuild. They don't let glass or rebar into Gaza still. So the war from 2008-2009 has still never been rebuilt. In fact, they still don't even have glass on their windows because they haven't allowed glass to come back in. The stuff, the information, I mean, if you want to take this information down and have a look for if it, for how it looks and works into your expertise, the group is called COJAD, the coordinating office for government affairs in the territories, and they ran a document called the Red Lines document, and it was released at the Israeli High Court because of a petition brought by a group called Gisha, which is against the blockade of Gaza, and in this court case, these documents were forced to surface. Documents that we have all known about for years because Israeli journalists have written about these meetings. But it's called the Red Lines document, and in it, it lists all the things that are going to be banned from import, which some of them are ridiculous, like no almonds, or for example, no conditioner, but shampoo. And so if you send a shipment of 2-in-1, for real, you can't get that in. That's the level. And what I was saying is that there is literally a caloric intake algorithm that is created by this office, this COJAD office, to break down caloric intake, demographics, and population distribution for how much wheat gets in, for how much milk gets in, for how much, and it doesn't, of course, the human rights groups, Oxfam and whatnot, they're the ones stepping up and saying you can't have an algorithm because the algorithm doesn't take into consideration distribution. So just because you have it at the caloric number doesn't mean that Jamal in Jabalia is going to get the proper nutritional level. And the impacts of this are well known. I mean, they're as well known as medical statistics can be for a 5-year window of time. The chronic malnutrition. The COJAT, the Red Lines document, talks about three things. It says no prosperity, no development, no humanitarian crisis. So that's the paradigm under which the siege operates, and it's total. What I was saying was that we need to be careful. I wanted to try to bring, I mean, my experience there implores me to bring the dynamic from the political, from the society back here so that people can have a look at what I see every day. What I was trying to say was we should be careful with our language when we say that Gazans are starving to death as a way of implicating Israel, when they are virtually, I mean, they're kept right on the edge of that, but they don't starve because of their own political ingenuity. The tunnels, the trade through the tunnels is significant. Mutual aid and whatnot, they're taking care of themselves. In fact, economic growth in the Gaza Strip, according to the World Bank, outpaced economic growth in the West Bank, which is the model cities for these ghettos. It outpaced it in growth, even when you include the development aid from the West into the West Bank. When you include the aid, still, the blockaded Gaza Strip had better economic growth based on internal, mostly based on internal developments, restructuring Hamas government, redoing these kind of aspects, and the tunnel trade. The tunnel trade is significant.
Is this tunnel trade in Egypt?
Yeah. I mean, it's not with, it's illegal trade with Egypt.
But has that increased since Mubarak was overthrown?
Well, there's a level of chaos since, particularly, I mean, when you look at Egypt, the Sinai Desert, the area that sort of separates from the Suez to Gaza, that desert is, I mean, maybe if there's Egyptians in the audience, they'll cringe, but it's only nominally Egyptian. It's really what the people in the area would call the Bedouin Republic. And so Egyptian control over the Sinai, both related to the Bedouin reality and the Camp David peace agreement, is such that the number of soldiers, Egyptian soldiers, allowed to be in the Sinai, and Israeli soldiers, to prevent the amassing of troops on the border, limits the number of Egyptian troops allowed to be in the Sinai. And so in effect, what that did was allow there to be a semi-autonomous Bedouin Republic, which can then, it trades. I rode with them, actually, the smuggling roads, and sometimes the smuggling roads are like, you know, from me to David away from the checkpoint. You know, the road and guides will be coming with refrigerators and generators is the big one, right? Everyone, because there's no power in Gaza most of the time, so everyone wants generators. They're stacked up on a truck, you know, 20 feet high, and the truck with, some Bedouins hanging off the side of it is like this far away from the checkpoint. So the Egyptians made a lot of money charging black market tax on the trade, and sort of Mubarak was playing it both ways. And that's another significant element of the Egyptian uprising. We don't know yet if the tunnel trade will increase. The tunnel trade could be formalized. It wouldn't need to be a tunnel. If a people's government comes in place in Egypt, they're gonna have a border crossing. And that border crossing is gonna give the Palestinians the ability to have an export economy and an import economy, and for students to go to school anywhere in the world, and for people who need health. You know, the Gaza Strip was structurally de-developed by Israel. So when Israel occupied the Gaza Strip, they didn't allow Gaza to have, for example, a cancer hospital. So because it was all Israeli territory, they would say, well, if you have cancer, you can go to Hadassah in Jerusalem or whatever. You don't need to have a cancer hospital in Gaza. So they denied them those sophisticated specialty medicines in their Gaza hospitals. And then in 2005, they left, sealed the place off, and there's still no cancer hospital in there. So if Egypt is a true people's government, 100% support in Egypt for Palestinians, and angry support for Palestinians, which would manifest itself almost surely in like any election campaign, the Egyptian politicians would say, and no more of this for our brothers in Palestine. I'm going to do this and this and this. And that would be a core electoral pillar of anybody that runs in an Egyptian election. If there's a free Egyptian election, it'll be 8 enemies of Israel running against each other. And that's really the reality of the situation, that the prospects, if there is true democracy that comes out of these people's movements, is that it will completely change the game for Palestine. No longer will you have this Arab linchpin in Egypt, which deals with every conflict multilaterally, right? That's the benefit of having Egypt, is that Egypt can talk to Saudi Arabia, get Saudi Arabia on board. If Saudi Arabia's on board, all the Gulf sheikhs are on board. And now all of a sudden, when Israel's invading Lebanon, as we saw in 2006, it was the Arabs that backed that movement. In fact, it was Saudi Arabia, after the kidnapping of the or after the taking of prisoner of the soldiers, that Saudi Arabia said, let's bomb Lebanon. And that's how the Arab League operates with this linchpin of Egypt.